actually, and just share a marmokum with you.
A very fascinating marmokum that I just discovered on Shabbos. So it involves going back a little bit, but it'll segue back into what we're talking about. I wanted to share it with you. When we started talking about this parak, so we started off talking about tarumas and the question of what tarumas meant. Remember, we asked the question when the Mishnah says, "Ein lo alav ela tarumas." Does that come to emphasize that there is no Kli of Mammon, and that's the whole thrust? It's saying there's essentially nothing, just tarumas? Or is it a chiddush about tarumas, telling us that there is a chiyuv of, or there is a concept of tarumas between the two? And we discussed at the time various shitas as to what tarumas meant and how we could understand what its significance was. So I just wanted to go back to it for a moment, and it'll actually lead back into what we're talking about. Because over Shabbos, I was just happened to be looking at this beautiful journal, which is a very kedai to look at in general. I don't know how often it's published, but as far as I'm aware of, there's been about 6 editions of this publication so far in various formats. It's published by Torah Sa'adam La'adam. That's what it's called, the journal Torah Sa'adam La'adam. It's a journal of topics of Ben Adam L'Chaveru that is published by a machon called Torah Ha'adam La'adam. And it's really very serious and in-depth Ben Adam L'Chaveru Torahs. And they have 2 volumes that are just about one issue. They have 1 volume on Lo Sisna and 1 volume on Nekim Unatira. And then after that, the numbering takes over with these kind of journals where they have multiple articles. Very nice Lamdish articles, a little bit of Musar Machshava also, but a lot of very in-depth Lamdish and Halacha about the topics of Ben Adam L'Chaveru. And in this one, which is volume 4, should be available in the library. Lean at her if I have time. Maybe I will scan it and I'll send it to Jonathan to send out. It is a worthwhile background to the sugya. So there's an article here entitled Ein Lo Olav Ela Tarumas, basically discussing what tarumas means and going into a little more depth about the significance of tarumas. So just to highlight 2 things that they do in this article. So first of all, as we discussed, it discusses the question of what tarumas means. First of all, that issue that was the first point, is there a positive significance to tarumas, or just a way of saying there's no chi of mammon? And he notes that while the Tiferes Yisrael, for example, does understand the Mishnah as emphasizing the lack of chi of mammon, it sounds like from our parak and from all over, when tarumas comes up, that tarumas is a affirmative concept rather than a lack of something else. And therefore, we have to figure out what tarumas means. So if you recall, when we went through the concept of tarumas, so we mentioned a couple of possible interpretations. And among them, we mentioned that there is a view that it's a heter and a tira. And we had 2 questions working off of that, the idea that you're allowed to suspend the isser, lo siko v'lo sitor. So one question was, why should it be allowed if it's an isser in the Torah? And why should it be allowed practically? What does it do for us? So he addresses himself to that position, which he notes that many Achronim he adds to our list that we mentioned. First of all, he notes Rav Huttner talks about this in the Path of Yom Kippur, and he quotes from the Shuvas Marshag and a few others who talk about this. And he essentially discusses the idea here being that the reason the tira should be permitted is essentially like we said. So Baruch Shekivanu, we mentioned that in the Gemara Maseches Yuma, where the Isser is defined, so it says that there's a distinction to be drawn, that the Isser of Nekima Netira really applies only in these mundane circumstances where somebody neglects, somebody declines to lend you property, so you refuse to lend it back to him. So that's where you find don't take revenge or don't bear a grudge, meaning you'll lend it, but you'll say, I'm not a jerk like you. So if it's something where they actually did you some personal offense, that the Gemara calls Tzairu Degufa, so then it sounds like from the Gemara that's an exception to the prohibition of Netira. So he works off that position as well. He says that he thinks that's basically the idea here, and he goes through all the examples, which I'm going to share with you in a moment. He goes through all the many examples throughout Shas. It's not just our sugya, you know, it's all over the place, where tarumas comes up, and he says that essentially tarumas is applicable to circumstances where somebody causes you a loss in a way that it's not actionable. You don't have a real tfias din, you don't have the ability to actually recover the loss in Bezdin. So if they cause you this problem, anybody who does this to you, so then that would be in this category of Tzairi de Gufa, and therefore you're allowed to be noter. You're allowed to continue to bear a grudge because of that exception of Tzairi de Gufa. Now he notes in a footnote that some of the Svarim actually take it further, and they say, they refer to Lo Sikom Lo Sitor, and also Lo Sisna. So the footnote here, this article, by the way, doesn't have an author. It's credited to the Machon. Apparently it was written by the Institute. So the Institute that wrote this article, so they note in the footnote that they can't explain. Why there are some who throw in Lo Sisna Sechicha Bulvavecha, it's hard to say that these little grievances can justify sinna, that the Gemara talks about being justified if a person violates significant averus, but just because the person caused you a little bit of a problem. So it's hard to believe that it should justify sinna, and that they don't try to explain. But in terms of Nekimu Natira, first of all, in terms of Natira, it should be because of that category of Tzairi de Gufa that allows it to suspend that Isser. And then he notes, in the language of the Maharshag, also the Maharshag, I think we've mentioned in the past, the Maharshag was a great posek, Rav Shimon Greenfeld. He was a Talmud of the Maharam Shik. And the Maharam Shik himself was a Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. So he was a prominent grand Talmud of the Chassam Sofer. And when he writes this, so he includes not only Nathira, but also Nakima. Not only can you bear a grudge, you could also take revenge. Now that's even more of a Chiddush. But as the authors here note, it makes sense because if the whole Chiddush, the whole Heter is based on Tzairi de Gufa, so the Gemara applies that both to Nekima and Netira, so then it would make sense it would apply to both. But again, we still aren't so satisfied with that answer. This is just beyond what the article says. We're not so satisfied for a few reasons. First of all, we mentioned that the Heter, Tzairi de Gufa, is not so pasha. The Chafetz Chaim considers it to be a Sfeika Ladina, and you have to say Sfeika L'chumra. So it's not so clear that there really is practically a heter, or that it's a recommended heter. And in terms of it being recommended, the question of what is the toelas of bearing a grudge here. So he notes here that the Prisha writes that the significance of Tarumnus is that the individual has to be mafayis, the victim, and he has to try to settle things. He can't ignore it, he can't say that's life, that's business, and walk away. It's a real issue, and he should try to appease him. He says, I'm not sure everyone would agree with this, that does not mean that the victim has the right to demand money as compensation, because if he did, that would essentially be the same thing as a chi of mammon. You can't say there's no chi of mammon, but there is a chi of to calm him down, and that could involve paying him money. It would come out to the same thing. So it doesn't mean you have to pay him, it means you have to find some way to calm him down and to acknowledge that he's been victimized and to not treat it as nothing. Hi.
Would it be permissible if you wanted to calm down in money? Just say that I think you're wrong.
Yeah,
it
would for sure be permissible, but the idea that it reflects some obligation on the part of the victim, we're actually going to talk, I think we did get up to this point, so we talked about Ribbis, it's a kind of a synergy, so I think this was actually the last point we got up to last Thursday, the bridge between last Thursday's and next Thursday's session. So the last thing we talked about on Thursday in the Ribbis shir was the question of, are there circumstances when you can voluntarily or even be forced to pay a monetary fine for delayed payment? The normally definition of ribbis is that I wait longer for my money so I get interest. But what if it's not built into the system that just because there's a term of a loan I get interest, but the person is overdue in paying? He should have paid by a certain date. He didn't pay by that time, and he caused problems by not paying on time. The lender suffered some type of situation because he didn't have his money when he needed it. So is it permissible for the borrower to pay for that, to pay restitution? And as we mentioned in that shir, it's a two-pronged question. Is there a chiyuv? Is that basically what we're talking about? It's essentially a grama, so is there a chiyuv to pay for it? And separate from the question of there's a chiyuv, is it mutter to pay for it? Is it considered to be ribbis? So that was a big discussion. We mentioned there's a 100-page article about this in a different journal. But there is a strong basis to say that it's not ribbis, and that even if it's not a chiyuv, it's appropriate. That it is something that the person wants to voluntarily address, that it is appropriate for, we have to first say it's mutter, it's not ribbis, and then if we say it's not ribbis, then many did feel that it's appropriate for a person who caused problems to his lender because he delayed paying when he was supposed to address that monetarily. So the point these authors are making here is that you can't say they're obligated to do that in a taruma situation, not necessarily in the ribis case we're talking about, but in the taruma cases in our gemaras, you can't say that you're mechuyev to pay because that will be the same thing as having a chiyev mamon, but you're mechuyev to try to appease the guy. So he can't force you to pay to appease him. He can't say, I refuse to come down unless you pay me, but if the person decides that's what he thinks is fair, then presumably he could volunteer to pay in order to accomplish that. And then at the end of the article, he does mention also, which we thought was the more likely interpretation, that it's not about bearing a grudge, but it's a heter to discuss it, to talk about it, point out that maybe the word tarumis itself refers to speech. This was an issue that is discussed in the Meforshim on our page, that the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Bracha says that they didn't put Asaras HaDibros in davening because of tarumas haminim, because the minim would somehow start up. So what does that tarumas got to do with this tarumas? Doesn't seem to have any kind of relationship. So unless tarumas is milashin tarumas dibor, that people start up, they say things. So in that context, it means that the heretics would say something that only the Asaras HaDibros is misinai. And so to hear, it's a heter to say things, a heter to talk about. So just... it's also worth noting, as we raised the question when we first saw this, that you have to still figure out, presumably it means that it's l'toelas, that it's lashon hara l'toelas. So it's a good question what the toelas is. And without a clear answer, is the toelas that you should prevent others from falling into this problem? Somewhat along the lines of an Amazon.com review or something like that, an internet posting where a business has ratings and you share your experiences that are not actionable but less than positive, so a person who's going to do business will know that this is what he's likely to get himself into. They talk about the customer service in the restaurant or whatever it is, so you should know what you're likely to encounter. Or is it for your own purposes, that maybe if you plug this back into what we said a second ago from the Prisha, that the person has to settle with you? So one way to make him settle with you is the fact that you're going to talk about it. So he's going to have to address it, because otherwise you're going to tell the world how he treated you. So perhaps for your own toelis, you have the right to prompt him to settle with you, because you'll have a heter to talk about it. So either way, that could be an understanding of tarumas in the sense of dibor, and that's probably, again, the most likely interpretation of what tarumas means in our context. So he goes through in this article, and maybe if I get a chance, I'll scan it and send it out. It's definitely worthwhile reading. If I don't send it to you, you can get it in the library. It's a Chayav Dalit. Aaron, question about that?
In just in terms of the context of the Gemara, so the Gemara, it calls Tarumas when the Gemara goes back to saying that the Baal Bayis said four and the people said three. So the Gemara says maybe that's the case of Tarumas because Alkina told me Bala. Mm-hmm. Isn't it clear from that context? Is that sort of the what's forced when Abi Zacharin to say that it has something to do with some sort of ethical or moral demand which you can put on the person?
I mean, as opposed to being nothing.
Meaning, I don't know, as opposed to just being an inactionable claim that you actually.
Yeah, no, that is one of the rights.
Sort of because you question her about him, or as like the Nesipir says that it's.
Excuse me, Yashua Bato.
Yeah, right.
Right. Yeah, no, that is essentially one of the proofs that it's not nothing. That he actually discusses that here in this article, that the possibility that it's just a way of saying as though chiyuv mamon is unlikely because of passages like that, which seem to say that there's something more affirmative about the tarumas. So then, just it's worth the reading. So maybe either you can get it from me, or you'll get it from the library. But he lists all the different examples, and especially as we've said, we're interested in some of the halacha lemaisa implications of this parak. So for every example, he categorizes the different examples in Shas, and then after he categorizes, it has a little section here, b'chaim, how these things, chayi yom yom, how these things could come up in your day-to-day life, and what type of things to be aware of. So basically the way he titles these things, he lists about 7-8 different things where a person could have tarumas based on different phrases in the Gemara. And just to quickly identify some of them, he says that if there is a hidden flaw in a item or in a shidduch, something we talked about a little bit in our Hazav discussions, a flaw that's not enough to cancel the sale, but enough to annoy you. if somebody withholds information from you that could be useful in your life, somebody does business with you in a way that they rent you an item which is not workable, for example, and ends up breaking, and it's not enough that they've dealt with you falsely, but they basically didn't work hard enough to provide you with quality material, so you ended up suffering a little bit. If there is a nullification of an agreement in business or a changing of the details, the nullification of the employer-employee relationships that we read about in our Mishnah, a middleman who is supposed to arrange something for you and doesn't deal with the details appropriately, somebody who creates the impression that things will be more beneficial to you and end up disappointed, which seems to overlap a lot with Gnevas Das considerations. And then the final category he has here, which leads us right back into our sugya, is Hamavatel Kiso Shel Chavero, somebody who creates a situation where somebody loses out, which is generally not actionable, so that is also a situation where you have tarumas. He also has a few other examples in the footnotes. If somebody says he'll help you out and then ends up complaining about the effort he has to help you out. And they basically summarize it by saying, Atzara Shava Shabachalat Siurim, Hapogea Bechavero B'mamono, the common element is somebody who offend somebody or his money, but often she'ein chiyuv mamon chiyotze b'zeh. There is no chiyuv that's actionable. Ach garim lo hefsid, but he causes him a problem, causes him some kind of a loss. So just now to segue back into what we've been talking about. So his last example here is mevato kiso shel chavero, because as we know, normally such a person is pater. Normally you don't have a chiyuv mamon, so all you would have is tarumas. And we've been discussing why is that not true according to the psak of the Shulchan Aruch and according to the implication of Tosfos over here in Ayin Vav Amud Beis, that if somebody hires workers and then pulls out and the workers are not able to get another job, so then the Baal HaBayis is chayiv to pay them. So we've discussed so far basically two approaches. One approach that the question is a good one and there's no good answer. In other words, there is no such chiyuv against the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. And the second approach, the one that Tosfos and the Rosh and other Rishonim have, is that this is called garmi. And as we started to explain, that grama is pater. If you cause a hezek, you are exempt. But garmi is a different category, which is also causational, but a little bit more traceable to you. And we tried to figure out why is this garmi rather than grama, and we saw a few possibilities. Some understood it to be a more definite situation, that grama involves some type of suffix, whether it actually will lead to a real problem, and this is more definite. Another approach based on the Rishonim who say that garmi is when you act on the chefta that gets broken itself rather than indirectly. And here you are directly impacting the worker himself. It's not like you're locking up his door, but you're locking him in a closet, and that's more direct. And that perhaps there is such an idea in general that Poland, the whole nature is more sensitive, and therefore we're more cognizant of damages to a Pole's ability to work than we are to anything else. And we also mentioned an approach that the Ksos discusses and others, that since the Torah has a concept of Sheves, so then that itself tells us that there is an obligation here. The whole notion of Sheves is that if I hurt somebody and he's not able to work, so then I have to pay for his lost work. So isn't that somewhat comparable to what we're talking about here? I stop somebody from working, so therefore I should have to pay for his lost work. And we discuss whether or not that was a sufficient explanation. We mentioned that this is all discussed in the Ksos, right? We mentioned that some says Sheves should only apply if you do direct damage to the person's body, not a situation such as this. The other problem that was raised is that maybe it should only apply to the time when you can't work because you're injured or because you're, in this model, locked up somewhere else, but not the work that you don't have because you weren't able to get it earlier when you were indisposed. And we also mentioned the open question whether or not Sheves is adjudicated b'sman hazeh, it's a machlokas, the Mechaber and the Ramah, and it would seem to be quite a chiddush to say that this halacha in the Shulchan Aruch only applies according to the opinion that Sheves is practiced today. So those were all within that approach. So that really still, those are all sub-branches, but it's still basically, we've seen really two approaches. Either Shulchan Aruch is wrong, like the Maharam Rutenberg seemed to say, or that is mitin dina degarmi. So far, so good? Okay, so now to discuss a third approach. It's the approach that some of the other Rishonim have over here. A lot of the other Rishonim, such as the Ramban and the Ritva and the Rashba and others. And that essentially this is a special chiddush that is a function of the Poel Balabais relationship. And the truth is, the Shulchan Aruch seems to be working off of actually this view. Because the phrase the Shulchan Aruch uses, Davar Ha'avud, that's really the key phrase. That there is a halacha that we read about here in our parak, that if the Balabais hires workers, and the workers pull out after the work has been started in such a way that there's no time for anyone else to come in and finish it before the items that are used get destroyed, get wasted, get messed up somehow. So then the workers are liable for that. It's a davar ha'avud situation. Now how do you make the workers liable for something? Right, so that's discussed in our Mishnah. Right, this whole din is in our Mishnah. Kol davar she'avad v'chazru behen. Right, makom she'ein sham adam. So if there is something that's going to cause a loss to the balabais, his materials are going to be wasted, and the workers have pulled out, so the balabais has an option. What can he do? Socher alehen o matan. What does that mean? So either he can, let's say if he's paid them something or if he has to pay them something, so he can subtract from their wages to hire somebody else. And the chiddush being, well, of course he's going to do that if he only did half the work. So for sure he's only going to pay them half and take the other half to pay whoever's going to finish the job. But the chiddush is, what if the rates have gone up? And so let's say now to hire somebody new, he's going to have to pay more. So he can subtract the extra that he has to pay out of what he owes these workers. And possibly even more than what he owes them. That's a whole discussion of halacha, what that means. We'll get into the details of that separately. But that's one option. One option is that the balabais has the right to take off of their salary in order to hire somebody else. And the other possibility is umatan essentially can deceive them, because they're doing wrong by him, so he has the right to say, listen, I'll pay you double, whatever it is, I'll push you further, to encourage you more to finish the job, and then when they finish the job, he's not really bound to that because they did inappropriately to begin with, he's only obligated to pay the original rate. So these are remedies that are available to the balabas if the worker pulls out in a way that causes him a loss. So some of the Rishonim say it's essentially reciprocal. So this is a din, this is a chiddush in the balabais poel relationship, this davar ha'avad idea. So if you have the balabas causing this problem for the workers, he pulls out, so they lose their money because they can't work for anyone else anymore. So then, the same way they're chayiv to pay him, if they let his materials go to waste, so he's chayiv to pay them if he lets their hours go to waste. So essentially, that's a chiddush in the din of poel. So there is an interesting point that's stressed by the Ksos. Again, it's worth reading the Ksos over here in Shin Lamed Gimel in the beginning. So he quotes a kasha from the Maram Shif. And he says as follows, that Maram Shif notes, but it's not really parallel. Why is it not really different? Because in the case, the Mishnah tells us, where the balabais can extract compensation from the workers, the workers don't really pay any money out of their pocket, at least on the surface. Either they get their wages garnished in order to pay a different worker, or they get pushed into working despite their desire not to work. But the idea that there is a chiyuv mamon, that there's some type of damages to pay, we don't really see that. And, in fact, the din is, according to some of the Rishonim, just to emphasize this point, that let's say the worker decides, let's say the balabayas, the boss, decides not to pursue one of these remedies. Right? In the scenario in the Mishnah, he has materials that are about to go to waste. So how can he save them from going to waste and from losing the money? He can quickly hire other workers out of the wages of these workers, or he can convince these workers to go back to work. Those are two remedies he can do to save his materials. But what if he doesn't do either of them? He just sits on his hands and he lets the materials go to waste. Can he make the workers pay? Can he say, now my stuff got ruined, you got to pay for the damages? So some of the Rishonim say in that case, no. So the Maram Shif says, this emphasizes there isn't any monetary obligation the workers have. There's just a remedy the boss has that he can use their work relationship to keep his stuff from getting destroyed. But if he doesn't avail himself of that, then there's no monetary obligation. So why should it go the other way, that he should have to pay them? There's no basis in this din of a monetary obligation. You see his question? Should I say it again? Everybody get it? Yeah, I'd be happy to repeat. Basically, the chiddush of these Rishonim is that it's not based on Nezikin, apparently. It's not based on Dina Degarmi. But there is a chiddush in the relationship between a boss and an employee that comes out of our Mishnah called a Davar HaAvad. That even though theoretically they could pull out, either one could pull out, but if you inflict a loss upon the other, so then you're chayiv to remedy that loss. So just like the workers have to remedy the loss of the materials if the material gets spoiled because they pulled out, so too the boss has to remedy the worker's loss if he pulls out on them and they can't get other employment. So the question that Maram Shif raises is that it's not really parallel, because there is no monetary obligation that the workers have to the boss. It's just there's a different kind of remedy the boss has to make sure his stuff doesn't get ruined. And if he chooses not to pursue those remedies, he can't collect, according to some Rishonim, at least he can't collect from the workers. So that shows that there isn't even theoretically a monetary debt that the workers have. So how do we use that concept to say the other direction, that the boss has a debt to them? So the Tzos has a valuable distinction between the two to explain it. Anybody want to share it or take a stab at what it could be? So essentially, what is the agreement? Right, the agreement that the workers make to the boss is that they'll do work. So if their failure to live up to that agreement causes him a problem, he has the right to use their agreement to work as a remedy. But what's the deal that the boss makes to the workers? That he'll pay them. And if his failure to live up to that agreement causes them problems, so then the remedy is in the same area. So the way the Tzos explains, it really is parallel, that in both directions, the remedy is that if you cause a problem to the other party by pulling out, you are forced to remedy it within what you had agreed to do. So the workers have to work, or let somebody else work with their salary. And the boss has to pay. So essentially, the nature of this Davar HaAvad din is that even though you may otherwise be able to pull out, if the pulling out causes a problem, so then we can force you to live up to your initial agreement to remedy the problem that was caused. That's a viable possibility. So that's essentially the way these Rishonim understand it. Now, this is different than what we just said. Rabbi Akiva Eiger in his Chidushin emphasizes that these reason two and reason three are different reasons. Dina Degarmi is Mehilchus Mazik, and this is Hilchus Polim. And there are differences, lahalacha, between the two reasons. What are some of the differences? We'll come back to it. I want to go through the other reasons before coming back to what the differences in any of these reasons might be. But just in case these two seem similar, just remember for now there are differences. We'll discuss further on what those differences could be. But just categorically, reason two was about Hilchos Nezikin, and reason three is about Hilchos Polim, essentially has to do with the agreement between the two parties being imposed in a case of loss. A fourth approach that you find, this is very kedai to see. There is a very important ritva, which is quoted in the Shita Mekubetzes, and it's quoted Lahalacha and a lot of other places too. It's a dispute how much it impacts Lahalacha, but it's a very important idea. And the ritva essentially invokes another Gemara about somebody who asks a employee or a friend, he asks a shliach to go buy him some wine. It's a place Gemara calls Zalshaft, something like that, but let's give a modern version of it. Let's say there is a unique scenario where somebody has the opportunity to get materials at a low price. There's a place where you can, for some period of time, buy an item at a lower rate. So this guy sends a messenger to go buy the wine for him at this lower rate. And the messenger fails to do so. So the Gemara says that he is obligated to pay for the difference. Now the original sender cannot get wine at the same price, he has to pay a higher price. So because he lost out that his shliach didn't do his job, so the shliach has to pay the difference, has to make up the difference between the higher price and the lower price. So why is that? Right? It's just basically a grama, right? He didn't break anything. He didn't steal anything. Why does this messenger have to pay the difference from cheap wine and expensive wine? Michael?
The Baal might not have sent the shliach if he knew that it was going to be more expensive.
Well,
The wine was going to be more expensive.
Well, he knows that if the shliach doesn't do it, he's left with a more expensive option.
Right.
Right, that's what happened. The
shliach assumption is that the shliach is going to fill his
right.
Price.
So that's so since his assumption that the shliach was going to do his job, so therefore what?
So therefore, the shliach should have to pay because the Baal would not necessarily have bought the wine otherwise.
I think you're saying the same thing, but you say it the opposite way. He would have bought the wine. Had the Baal not sent the shliach, he would have gotten it himself. That's really, I think, what we're looking for. This guy could have bought the cheap wine himself. Why didn't he? Because he thought his shliach was going to get it for him. He asked somebody to do this job, and the guy told him he was going to do it. And because he thought the shliach was going to do it, he didn't do it himself. And he lost his opportunity. So because he trusted that guy to do the job and the guy didn't do it, that's where he lost out. Jonathan, is that what you want to say?
A little bit differently.
Okay.
You could say maybe that he's not interested in the product at all. He's just interested in getting cheaper commodities and just in resale value. He couldn't care less if it was wine or baseball cards or whatever. So since he lost out on that opportunity of reselling things at a normal market price, that's where he'd be penalized for.
Maybe. We don't necessarily know that that's the case.
Right.
But how do you know? Why isn't that not grama, though? Still. You know, basically, he lost out on this potential profit.
Right.
Not directly. The guy didn't break his stuff with a bat. The guy didn't steal his money out of his pocket.
Okay.
So the central problem is still there. But what the Ritva emphasizes is, since I relied on this guy to do the job for me and I lost out because he didn't do it, so therefore that's considered to be also a chi of mama. And he connects this to a whole other fascinating sugya, which is the Gemara in the end of Maseches Bava Basra, and the very end of Bava Basra and the beginning of Maseches Kedushin. You may have encountered it there if you've learned either of these Maseches. And it is also relevant to Ribbis. So we touched upon it a little bit last Thursday. There is a din in the Torah called Arev. We probably talked about it also in Parshashir, either Miketz or Vayigash. It comes up in both places. That there is a halacha that one can accept responsibility for someone else, which is in a fascinating way. The Gemara in Baba Basra derives it lahalacha from Yehuda and Binyamin, which is itself a whole fascinating discussion. Yehuda accepted responsibility for Binyamin, and the Gemara says that's how we know there is such a thing as a cosigner, which has major implications for Hilchos Ribbis. That if, let's say, Aaron wants to borrow money from Jonathan, and Jonathan doesn't trust Aaron, so, of course, trust me, so I say, I'll co-sign. I say, Jonathan, trust me, I'll sign the document also, lend the money to Aaron. And there's a major chiddush lahalacha that if Aaron indeed defaults on the loan, so Jonathan can come to me. Different types of are, if he can he come to me right away, can he only come to me after Aaron can't pay, but ultimately he can come to me and make me pay. So the Rishonim have a big discussion. There's 5 or 6, 7 views in Rishonim how that works. Right? Why should I have to pay Jonathan the money? I didn't borrow any money. Aaron borrowed the money. I didn't benefit from the money at all. There is a Chiddush of Arev that somehow says that I have to pay. So the Rishonim have different explanations why it is. So the way Taka, the Ritva over there in Kedushin explains, seems to be L'shitaso, that essentially because I told you to lend the money, right? So Jonathan, I told you to lend the money to Aaron, and you trusted me, and you lent the money because I said so. So therefore, I'm liable. So similarly, the Ritva here says, the same Din Ariv tells me that if I trusted Jonathan to get me this cheaper wine, and because I trusted him, I didn't do it, and he told me to trust him, not Stam, I decided to trust him out of nowhere, he agreed I should trust him, so then he is liable to pay whatever I lose out from that context. Now there's a bigger chiddush, because it's still a loss of potential profit. In the case of a loan, I took money out of my pocket, which I was hoping to get back, and I didn't get it back, so it's more of a direct kind of loss. But this is what the Ritva says based on this idea that there is a chiyuv mamon based on that. That if I trust somebody to do something and they tell me to trust them, I trust them to do it, and they fail to do it, so then I am able to collect money for that loss. So too here, I told these workers I was going to give them a job, and I failed to do it, and now they lost money because they relied on me. So then, says the Ritva, you're chayiv to pay for that. Midin Arev. Now this is a very, very important din. As you can imagine, this has major implications. L'halacha, is this true? Right, if somebody tells somebody else to do something, make it worth your while, and then they spend money on that assumption and it doesn't work, are you chayiv to pay? I think I remember one time I was learning Bav Mitzi at the same time, this would have to go back a while, when Ross Perot was running for president. So it goes back a while. And he ran for president and then dropped his campaign and then he started again later. So during the time when he withdrew, there was this woman, I recall, she wanted to sue him because she said that she was a supporter and she was investing money and effort in pursuing his campaign, and then he decided he wasn't going to run. She wanted to collect the damages. I was wondering at the time if maybe this has some basis in the Ritva Shita, that she only put out these expenses because he said he was going to do something. He said he was going to make it worthwhile in his running for president, and if he failed to do that, maybe her trust of him justifies her collecting a debt afterwards. You have to figure out whether it's exactly parallel or not. But in any event, it's a very big question whether or not this Ritva is accepted lahalacha, because as you can imagine, it has tremendous implications. Jonathan?
Just to clarify, in the case of what the Rav is saying, in the case of the Shliach or the Arev, it's because he instigated the deal that you should trust me, therefore that's...
Not so much instigated, because even if the other person instigates, but the first guy agrees, it would be the same. But if I let you trust me, I tell you to trust me, in the case of the Arev, maybe in the other scenario, maybe there is an instigation from the other guy. But in our case, it's not necessarily instigation, but he agreed to be the trustworthy person. So whoever starts the story, I don't know if it matters, but if there is, at the end of the day, a trust between A and B, so then if B fails to live up to that trust, so then there is a liability, even though it would otherwise be considered grama, right? That whatever loss is brought about is causational and is potential profit and is indirect. Nonetheless, it becomes his responsibility because of the nature of the trust relationship. That since he told the other guy to trust him or agreed that he should be trusted, so then that makes a grumman to an actual chiyuv, and that's the chiddush of Arif. And that's all derived from, in a fascinating way, from Yehuda telling Yaakov, trust me, I can take care of Binyamin, otherwise I take upon myself all of his issues. It's a really fascinating idea. So la halacha, it's also worth noting that the Chassam Sofer in the Tshuva has a discussion where he says that he thinks the Ritva is 100% right. He thinks that the logic of the Ritva is very solid. And he says, he thinks the halacha, that if you have a situation where somebody trusted another person, and it's not so clear the loss correlates to that, okay, then there'd be no chiyuv. But if it's 100% clear that the loss was caused because A trusted B and B fell down on the job, so then the Chassam Sofer says he thinks it makes sense there really should be a chiyuv, that the Ritva is correct, as long as it really is clear that the loss connects to that. However, in the last line, he then goes on to say, but there may be some other Rishonim who throw a little bit of question into it, so it's not 1,000% sure it's really the Halacha L'maisa, so if it comes to him, he would probably seek out some kind of a pshara, he would try to settle the issue somehow. But the thrust of most of his tshuva is that he thinks the Ritva is correct logically and possibly the Halacha as well. And the Nesivis is also a very major authority in Dine Mamnis. The Nesivis also seems to think that the Ritva's view is shared by other Rishonim. He says the Ravid says like this, and maybe a few others. And he thinks also that there is a stability to that position. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger, in his Chidushim, says it on his own. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger says he thinks that that's Pshat on this din. And he says he doesn't understand why Tosfos and the Rush have to kvetch with Dina Degarmi. Why don't they just say like this? They think that this is Pashav Shah. So those are some pretty big names, the Chassam Sofer, and Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and the Nesivis. Nonetheless, in the Sefer Mishpatei HaChoshen, if you take a look, so he quotes that he thinks that at the same time there are many others who disagree. So he's not so sure of the halacha that there would be a solid chiyuv moment in such a case. So if it comes up, you'd have to have a real din Torah, because there is really what to talk about here. There is, it still could come down, and we talked a little bit about the principles of Kimli. So we have one day, Shitas Yachid, isn't Shulchan Aruch, etc. So it's interesting, it still could come down to basically one view in Rishonim, really the Ritva. But the Ritva may have some pretty solid support from some of the Gedolei Achronim, from the Chassam Sofer and the Nesivis and Akiva Eiger. So you have to figure out exactly what the halacha would be in terms of Kivli, in terms of who would win in such a case. If it comes up, it's really a basis for a significant discussion, because there is what to declare based on this. But this Ritva, definitely, if you haven't had a chance to see it, you probably have seen the Shidim Mekubetzis, definitely tomorrow you should take a look at this Ritva. Very, very significant view, not only in this sugya, but comes up in a lot of other places as well, as possibly impacting Halacha L'maisa. So essentially, we'll just mention one more view. So one more view is the Nesivis. The Nesivis, who also picks up on the Maram Shif's Kasha, mentioned a few minutes ago, right? The lack of parallelism between, if you say Davar HaAvid is the reason, the lack of parallelism between the Balabayas and the workers. And the Nesivis says he thinks that the answer is in both cases, in both directions. The whole concept here is a Takanas Chacham. That really, there is no Chiyuv, like the Maram Rutenberg had said. That in terms of Dini Mamanis, it's a Garmi, there is no real, it's a Grama, there is no real Chiyuv, Vatel Kiso. And there is a special Takanas Chachamim to protect the labor market, to protect Poland and their employers, and to make sure they don't lose out when one party backs out. So the Chazal made a Takana that there should be a way to compensate, there should be a way to remedy the loss. But you can't ask kashas on it because it's a Takanas Chazal. They just made this mechanism so that either side can seek out some type of compensation if there is a problem. So those are the basic views that you have. Essentially, it comes out to five answers as to how to explain or how to address. They don't know what to explain, how to address the position of the Shulchan Aruch, that even though the baseline din is Nochi of Mammon, Ein Lo Ela Tarumis, but if there is a loss to the worker, then the boss does have to pay. So we saw basically five approaches. The approach of the Maharam Rutenberg that it's Brahma, there is no Chiyuv. We talked about implications there. The approach of some of the Rishonim, Tosus, and the Rush, and others, that it's not just Brahma, it's Garmi, so there's a Chiyuv. And we talked about different ways to explain why it's not Brahma and why it should be called Garmi. The approach of other Rishonim, that it has to do with the Chiddush of the Balabayas Polo relationship and the din of our Mishnah of Davar Ha'avud, and how to explain whether they should be parallel or not, the Ketzos and that whole story. Or the fourth view, the view of the Ritva, that's Midin Arev, and that if somebody promises you, trust me, and you lose that money because of that, so that there is a Chiyuv, even though it would otherwise be considered causational. And the halach lemaisa discussion that surrounds that. And the fifth approach that says that the whole din, everybody's right, there is a chiyuv, but the Maharam Rutenberg is right that there is no chiyuv min haTorah, and that the chiyuv is a takanas chachamim, so we don't have to answer any questions, Chazal just put this into play in order to keep the labor employer markets protected, and we don't have to explain how it works from a lamdisha perspective. So those are the basic views. Now the next question is, does it make a difference? Does it have any impact halacha lemaisa which view you take? It does probably make a difference. So God willing, tomorrow we'll pick up with talking about some of those differences and maybe just fill in a few other halacha lemaisa points about this. There is a little bit to add. And God willing, by tomorrow we should finish this and then move on to Pol Yochel Achzu B'Chatzi Yom and related sugyas. All right, I wish everyone a fantastic day.